Let me just start off by introducing myself. My name is Josh Barron. I'm the Director of Academic Technology and E-Learning at Marist College, and I'll talk a little bit about Marist a little bit further into the presentation if you're not familiar with us. I'm also currently serving as Chair of the Sakai Foundation Board of Directors, so kind of wear two hats, both in my career, and I will do so in this presentation as well a little bit. I'll start off with a brief apology. As you may have seen in the program, a number of my colleagues from Marist were supposed to be up here with me. A series of scheduling conflicts knocked two of them out. One of them was going to be here, and then unfortunately had a family emergency, had to fly back home this morning. So hopefully I'll be able to cover well for them. Before I jump into the actual presentation, I just wanted to get a little feel for what brought you here to this session. So maybe a quick show of hands. How many folks are maybe running Sakai in production at your institution today? A few people, good, okay. Hopefully you'll stick around then, hear about our evaluation. How many people are piloting or evaluating, kind of looking at Sakai right now? Okay. And how many thought we were going to be evaluating sushi? How many people have seen me have this joke before? All right, well, I can at least use it a couple more times then. But actually, the real question is, how many people know where the Sakai name came from? That's a better indicator of your knowledge, a few people. So. I'll use that as a teaser to have you stick around to the end, and I'll answer that question. You'll probably have to remind me. I'll probably forget. So let me just kind of a quick rundown of what I'll try to cover in the 50 minutes or so that we have together. I'll start with a kind of brief, very brief overview of what Sakai is, just for folks who may not be familiar, have a big picture view of what not just the software is, but the community and open source program around Sakai. I'll briefly talk a little bit about the Marist journey down the Sakai path, both from the institution perspective as well as a little bit of my own personal journey, but spend most of the time talking about the actual evaluation that we did at Marist of Sakai over about a one and a half, two-year period, talk about some of the criteria that we set, and also, probably most importantly, the outcomes from that evaluation. I'll hit just really one slide to the last two bullets on kind of where we are today. We've just finished our institutional-wide conversion over to the Sakai this fall, and talk a little bit about where our next big things are focused on. And then hopefully have about 10 minutes at the end for Q&A. We got a relatively small group here, so if you got a question as I'm going through it, don't hesitate to raise your hand and ask, and I'll do my best to answer this as we go, or we'll just table it to the end. So let me kind of start at the beginning in terms of Sakai's history. Again, just really briefly to give you an understanding of where Sakai has come from. As many of you may remember, in the early 1990s, a lot of R1 research institutions, universities here in the United States began to build out their own learning management systems. And it happened very organically over a number of years. But by the late 1990s, early 2000s, many of these institutions realized that these products had basically reached the end of their life. They're built on older technologies. The web had exploded. So they really realized they're going to have to replace these systems. And they faced a very common IT dilemma, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with the build or buy question, or really for them, build again or go off and buy. And they had learned a lot of lessons over the last decade in terms of the complexity of building out learning management systems on their own. They took on a lot of risk doing that as a single institution. So that wasn't a particularly attractive path to continue down for them. They then went on to look at commercial options, all the big vendors out there in the space. These were very, very costly options and also very inflexible. So they had really gotten used to having the ability to customize their systems for their local needs. That was very, very difficult, or at least very expensive with a proprietary vendor solution. And so I think really a great testimony to the creative problem solving of a number of key folks at a few institutions. They kind of decided that they didn't like those two options, so they're going to come up with a third, which was to come together as a consortium and work together to build out a single LMS that all of the institutions could easily customize to meet their own local needs. And that's really where this concept of community source really got born out of. In 2004, the core institutions listed here, Michigan, Stanford, Berkeley, MIT, received a kind of seed grant from the Mellon Foundation to start the Sakai project. And fast forward to today, we've just recently released version 2.6.1, which I think is arguably, competes with any other enterprise level learning management, course management system out there. And I think is really great proof that this community source model, which back then a lot of people questioned, I think shows that it's really reached maturity and has been successful. So let me now just kind of turn a little bit to Sakai specifically, because I think it's really important to understand that, you know, most people look at Sakai or think about Sakai as a piece of software, a learning management system, or we prefer to call it a collaborative learning environment because it really supports more than just formal teaching and learning. That's a logical place to start. It's obviously the tools, the capabilities are what your faculty members and students are most interested in. But there are a lot of other components to Sakai that I think are equally as important to understand. The community of developers and supporters and people who innovate the product, I think, are really, really critical. The open source model that's used to facilitate that development process and the foundation that helps coordinate that work are really differentiators in my mind between an open source option like Sakai and a proprietary vendor solution. So again, I just want to spend a couple of minutes here very briefly looking at each of these components. We'll start with the collaborative learning environment. For those who have maybe not seen Sakai before, just a quick rundown here on the kind of different tool sets. I'd like to categorize them to these four basic kind of groups. We have what we call course sites. These are a set of tools to support formal teaching and learning that can range from supplementing classroom-based instruction to fully online courses, which we do many of at Marist. We also have a very rich, fully integrated e-portfolio tool set. And if you're familiar with the Open Source Portfolio Initiative from a number of years ago, that project has been integrated and kind of folded into Sakai. So you also get this rich set of tools to support electronic portfolio and portfolio assessment. Another, and I think increasingly critical component, are project sites. And these are a suite of tools and permissioning that support more ad hoc collaboration. So this might be a faculty committee, an administrative group. We even have a lot of student clubs at Marist using project sites to do ad hoc collaboration. And then last but not least is the My Workspace area. This is a personal private space that every user gets. And you can deploy a range of tools, wikis, blogs, podcasts, as well as things just like a resource area for them to store their own files. So that kind of gives you a very high level, fairly quick overview of the different tool sets and capabilities in the actual product. Quick snapshot of the community. Very international, diverse community from around the world. We obviously have a predominance of institutions in the United States and Europe right now, but we have a lot of development activity coming out of places like South Africa and Australia. Just had a conference a couple of months ago in Australia in September, a Sakai conference there, a regional conference. We're starting to get interest in South America and Asia as well. I'm going to assume that most people are familiar at this point with the concept of open source. I won't spend much time here at all. We're following an open source licensing structure. There's no fees or royalties to download, use, or redistribute or modify the software. Probably in today's marketplace, the last bullet is the most important, I think, to be aware of. You cannot come and buy Sakai, so you really have some guarantee there that if you opt to use an open source model like Sakai, you're not going to end up having it bought out from underneath you and forced to change. And last, and sometimes I argue least important, although we have the executive director here in the room for the Sakai Foundation, so maybe I shouldn't say that, but the Sakai Foundation helps coordinate the activities of the community. And I think the important point here is that this is not a top-down board kind of structure. The board and the foundation don't go and tell programmers what to work on. They don't tell the community what they need to do. They're really there to listen to the community, hear what its priorities are, and then go off and take action to help coordinate those priorities. And I think this new product council, which you may have heard of if you've been following Sakai, is a good example of that. About a year and a half ago, the community really said, listen, we need some more coordination in the development process behind Sakai. The board got together for a retreat, and out from that came this concept of creating a product council of community members that would help shepherd the development process forward. Many other things here that are done by the foundation. I'll just highlight one more, which is the conferences we run every year, the International Sakai Conference. And if you're enjoying Denver, Encourage you to come on back for the 11th International Sakai Conference. It's be in June or July back here in Denver. So that was a really quick overview, and I want to move on to the heart of the presentation. But we've just recently launched a new Sakai website, so I'd encourage everybody to go to sakaiproject.org if you want to get some more information about any of the topics I just touched on there, or a lot more about the product itself, including places where you can go see demos of the product and actually mess around with it. So let me move on here to talk a little bit about the Sakai journey that we took at Marist College, and I personally took. And just again, for those who are not familiar with Sakai, quick snapshot here. Comprehensive liberal arts institution, located in Poughkeepsie, New York. It's about 2 hours north of New York City, along the Hudson River. We're a pretty small, mid-sized institution, so I don't think we're, at least in the past, what people have pictured in their mind when they think of a Sakai adopting school. We have about 5,700 students. I think probably the most important bullets are the last two here. We have maxed out our physical space on our campuses, so our strategic plan calls for significant growth in distance education. That's really where the revenue for Marist is going to come from over the next couple of years. And so our LMS, LMS is really a business critical technology for us. So this isn't just an add-on, a supplementary kind of technology that a few faculty members use occasionally. It's really part of our core business strategy. So let me take you back to a conversation back in 2005 that really got me started down this path of Sakai. And I like to share this because it's not where people probably think the chair of the Sakai Foundation Board got started or how I got started. I got pulled into a meeting with a couple senior muckety-mucks at Marist. We'll go nameless for now. And they had just heard about Sakai. They thought it was wonderful. And they were basically asking me to come in to start planning for a transition to this great new innovative product. But as they were telling me about it, I just kept hearing them talk about it being free and free and free, which I think was their major focus of saving money. Not a bad focus, but as the director of academic technology on the front lines with our faculty and students, someone at the time who had a lot of myths about open source, so I was not a big open source person, I was a bit concerned. So although I told them they were geniuses and very smart and that sounded like a great idea to me, I did literally go home and tell my wife that I thought I was going to be a dead man, because the idea of running an open source learning management system when our big growth was going to be in distance learning over the next 5 to 10 years made me quite nervous. So what I did was kind of hatch a little secret evil plan, which was to go down to the Sakai conference that year in Baltimore, identify all the reasons why open source and Sakai are a crazy move for Marist, come back and convince the administration that we should look at a priority vendor solution. I think at the time my preferences were WebCT and Angel, and I think if you follow the market for obvious reasons, I'm happy my plan failed there. So what I want to just do is use this opening little story here to talk a little bit about why my plan failed so miserably. And I think at the heart of it was a realization on my part and the staff in my office that the community source model that was emerging at that time really held the potential, and I'll stress at the time their potential, to transform the learning management industry in some very, very significant ways. So let me just touch on those for a few minutes here. You'll see as we go through the evaluation criteria that we established and used over the pilot that we ran, these innovation factors, as we called them, really became very, very critical in that evaluation or evaluation of Sakai. The first, at least in my mind, is maybe the most significant, this concept of Sakai or open source, community source systems being built by educators for educators. I'm not sure about your experiences, but mine has been that really innovative instructional technologies generally take a long time for faculty members to adopt. They just have long adoption curves. And I think the reason for that is that in order for them to really transform their teaching and learning styles and their instructional strategies to take advantage of these tremendously innovative new tools that are in their hands, it takes them a long time. It's a personal thing to be teaching. Some of them are teaching for many years, and that change process can take quite a while. So as a result, I think a lot of companies in this space, for-profit companies, tend to develop technologies that are more geared to the status quo instructional strategies that are used in today's classrooms, doing what I'm doing today, kind of lecturing. And I think, although I'll credit the publishing industry for making big strides in the last few years, when they got started, I think it was a great example of this. They bundled PowerPoint slides with their textbooks. That was their big first entry into the technology world. Why? Because that's what most faculty members do, is lecture off PowerPoint slides. So that made a lot of sense in terms of a profit margin for them. In Sakai, the bottom line isn't a profit margin. The bottom line is teaching and learning. And so if a number of innovative faculty members come up with a creative way of using a wiki or a blog or some other new technology to teach subject matter more effectively or radically improve some pedagogical practices, chances are that's going to be incorporated into the product. Again, removing that profit margin, I think, often has removed a limiting factor in terms of instructional technology innovation. The concept of crowdsourcing, which is a pretty common term today, was certainly quite new just a few years ago. And so we were quite intrigued by this idea that in a priority vendor kind of software company, you have a finite number of software engineers. So you have a number of people doing development work, design work, and so forth, but you have a finite number of people. In a community source project like Sakai, although at some levels, like the foundation, we have just a few people, as you go down into the community, we have several hundred very active contributors, arguably maybe more than you'd find in a software company. We have tens of thousands of instructors and now millions and millions of students using Sakai. And so if each one of them just puts in, let's say, an hour a year to help us innovate the product and come up with some new ideas, that's millions and millions of people hours that we can leverage in a community source model through crowdsourcing. The next one is one that we were also very, very interested in. Again, at the time, these were kind of the potential. We weren't sure that they would be realized. But this concept of decoupling code and service. And there's been a couple of sessions at the conference so far where this concept has been talked about. The idea is that in the world prior to community source, you tended to go off and buy a license to use a large enterprise learning management system or other piece of software, and you're then generally locked into also purchasing a support contract from that same vendor. And this concept of vendor lock-in that I'm sure you're familiar with. Well, in a community source model, we decouple these things. So you get the license, the code from the community, and then the service, support service, you can either do in-house or partner with one of the several commercial affiliates out there who will provide commercial grade services for you. The benefit here, though, is that we've reintroduced market forces back into the service equation. And so these service providers live and die by the quality of their service. And if they're not providing the service you like, you can pick up and go to a different service provider, but you don't have to change your core technology. You can still use Sakai. And so that was really something, particularly because of concerns over support services from some of these commercial vendors, was something that we really are very attracted by. Something that I think at this EDUCAUSE conference is the first time I feel like I can really say we're really starting to see this one getting realized today is the concept of open standards and interoperability. Again, just 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, this was really more of a concept than anything that was really happening. But the IMS Karma Core cartridges, the QTI standard, the SCORM standards are now quite prevalent. But one of the limiting factors, I think, for a long time has been this is obviously not a generally smart move for a for-profit business, because if you adhere to these open standards, it means that people can take content out of your system and easily move it to another system, and that generally is not the best business case for you. So I think community source, again, is one that embraces and supports these types of open standards. Again, drives a lot of quality into the product. Okay, so let me move on and talk now about the evaluation process and the criteria we used the outcomes from our evaluation, which obviously led to the selection and transition to Sakai. So we implemented what I sometimes refer to as a phase pilot model. we really felt we wanted to first start off with this kick the tires phase, pretty common. This was really just getting Sakai spun up, getting our IT folks to kick the tires around, understand how to install it. My staff thus messing around with it. We had a couple faculty members, students come in to look at it, but we really weren't doing any kind of real coursework or collaboration in it. In fall of 2006, we actually received some National Science Foundation funding to start a sort of online certification program for data center professionals. And we had written into that proposal that we would use Sakai for it. So it gave us a little seed money to bring Sakai up to speed in terms of running a production pilot. And so we started with one cohort of about 25 students, two faculty members, and ran real, fully online courses in Sakai as part of our pilot. And as kind of a side note for people who are looking to start piloting, this was a real advantage because we were working with a self-contained group. So these students weren't using our other LMS at the time. The instructors were adjuncts working actually from IBM, so they didn't have to deal with using two different LMSs at the same time, one for the IDSP program and one for their other courses. So it helped us keep kind of the pilot fairly contained at that early stage. And then in the fall of 2007, we decided that it was time for us, because of the success of the early pilot, to expand this significantly. And so we added about 400 to 500 students to the Sakai instance we were running, and about 15 to 20 faculty members began to use it. And at that time too, we decided that it was wise for us to partner with RSmart, which is one of the several commercial affiliates that provides commercial grade support services around Sakai. We'll talk a bit more about that decision. It was to go through the criteria. And because of the success, we also started to really engage our faculty members in conversations about what a transition was going to look like, make sure they're all aware that we were considering this transition, also worked with our college senior leadership, our dean's council, cabinet, and so forth, through a pretty robust communication strategy. In fall of 2008, I should mention that prior spring, the official decision was made to move to Sakai. In fall of 2008, we actually began our official transition, and we spent a full year running two LMSs, Sakai and our other older LMS, at the same time, giving faculty members a chance to kind of opt into using Sakai, them knowing that they had basically a year to do that. And then this fall, this past September, officially ended our transition and marked the point where all of our courses were now in Sakai. So at the very early kick the tire stage, again from some of our experiences at the Sakai conferences, we established these kind of five evaluation criteria, decision criteria, that we felt were really important for us to look at over this 2 year or year and a half or so period to make this decision about whether or not Sakai was right for our institution or not. And so I'll spend now the rest of the time pretty much going through each one of these and talking about the outcomes. What I'm not going to do is spend a lot of time on the methodology, because I think we use pretty standard methods here to assess these things. We did a lot of user surveys, focus groups of students and faculty members, individual interviews with some of our instructors, particularly in the sense of the power users. We did a lot of briefings on our senior leadership. And as I mentioned, and I think I'll stress it here because it was really a key component for us of our assessment, was attending all of the Sakai conferences, speaking to our peers who told us the honest truth about using Sakai and their experiences was extremely valuable in this evaluation process. So let me start off by looking at this functionality requirement area. And look at the timer. Okay, sorry. So a couple of key questions here that we were looking at, as you can imagine, understanding what kind of the functionality was going to be like was a key issue for our faculty and staff and students. So this was an area we spent a lot of time on. We worked with our users to really understand what were the critical capabilities that were going to be showstoppers for them. So meaning, you know, what had to be there in order for them to be comfortable transitioning systems. They all wanted to know what capabilities might they lose once we moved to Sakai. And we were obviously very interested in also looking at what kind of capabilities we would gain moving to Sakai. So the way we approach this is to run what we call a gap analysis. We started by defining over 250 distinct capabilities on our older LMS and just did a straight comparison going through Sakai and looking, can we do this thing in Sakai? And we created a pretty simple spreadsheet, a little snapshot there you can see, noting where those capabilities were not present in Sakai at the time. I think more importantly, though, we categorized these gaps into one of three categories: desirable, essential, critical. And we did this closely with our faculty body and students. And so they really came to us and told us what they thought were critical gaps. And the guarantee we made to them was that we would not transition to Sakai if we could not close those critical gaps. We also worked with them to identify essential gaps. And the agreement there was that, and these tended to be things that they felt were important to their teaching, but they could probably do without for a little while. And what we agreed to was if we had an essential gap and we were going to transition, that we would only do so if we had a near-term solution for closing that gap. So a tool was under development, would be available in the next version kind of thing. Desirable gaps were issues that were desirable, labeled desirable, were really things that were used by a very small minority of faculty members, and they were not very passionate about having those capabilities in the new system. So the outcomes, I think one that we weren't really doing this for but was a great outcome, was that this gap analysis acted as a great tool, a communications tool with our faculty body. So not only could they track the progress on these things, since we regularly updated the spreadsheet and distributed it to them, we were very honest with them. When there was a gap, we said, look, this is a gap. We know it's serious. We know it's not going to work unless we close this. And I think that honesty really helped build up confidence in the faculty body that we were going to make a decision that was really in their best interest and not just something we wanted to do. We also were able to close all of the critical gaps in the first year of that expanded pilot. And that really impressed our faculty body that issues that they said were really important to them were also really important to the other community members, and therefore those gaps got closed in the next release of the product because all the other institutions involved were working on those same issues. And we also found that Sakai had a lot of capabilities that our older LMS didn't. Just as one example, the electronic portfolio tools was a huge suite of tools that were not available to our faculty members in the older LMS. With things like Middle States accreditation coming up on our horizon, redesign of our core curriculum, our general education courses. There was a lot of interest in electronic portfolio, so people really saw that as a great advantage. Since we're now a little bit out, beyond the evaluation, I thought I'd update people on kind of where we are today with some of these things. So I'm also pleased to be able to say that all those essential gaps that we promised them that we would have solutions for have also been closed. And I won't go through the list here, but the first one I think was very significant. Earlier versions of Sakai had individual tools would display things as a student would see them. So let's say assignment tool would show you what the assignments looked like to a student, but there wasn't a global student view. So you couldn't go into a whole course site and see it just as a student would see it. But in the last release, version 2.6, that capability has now been built in, and we're able to close that essential gap. Staffing and support requirements. We, like I think many people, and some even today, had a lot of myths about having to add a lot more support staff to our office and our IT offices in order to run Sakai. And so we were very, very kind of focused on this in the early days of how many more support staff have to be added to my office to support Sakai. How many more Java developers are we going to have to add to our IT shop? Because we had this kind of myth that we needed programmers on staff to run the software. And also at the time, we really were very new to Sakai, the community. We didn't realize we were commercial affiliates. And so we were kind of in a mode of how are we going to live without commercial support. I really like having a phone number I can call when there's a big problem and get that person in line to help us out. And we were concerned about not having that. So in terms of the evaluation approach, we spent a lot of time talking to other institutions about the FTE resources they dedicated to Sakai, looking at how much Java code had to be written to run the product, and also began to become aware of some of the commercial support options and started to look at those as well. So this is just one example of the type of work we did. This actually was something that the Sakai Foundation, I believe, with some of the commercial affiliates produced. early on. And this gives you a snapshot of a couple different institutions, the number of FTEs, full-time equivalent staff, that they dedicate to running and supporting Sakai. And at the top, you can see it says code commits, and that's just an indication of how much development work those institutions are involved in, so how much code they contribute to the Sakai effort. And so places like Michigan, Stanford, these are institutions that were part of the original development effort, so they had put a lot of development time into Sakai, obviously have relatively high FTE headcounts. Obviously, they have relatively large numbers of students as well to support. But if you look down at the other end of the spectrum here, you can see that institutions that don't contribute much code at all have relatively small numbers of FTEs dedicated to it. And that was what really caught our attention, and we started to talk to those institutions and really began to understand that running Sakai was like running any other enterprise-level system. Yes, you need people to support it, but you don't need any more people to support it than a proprietary vendor solution. So I just mentioned that first one. We also really began to understand that we didn't have the right code to run the software. And again, now looking back, it's kind of an obvious answer to us, like running any other major system. If we're running it, we don't have to necessarily be writing a lot of code for it. So that really turned out to be a myth. And then we also obviously found that there were a lot of commercial affiliates out there that we could purchase commercial support from. So again, a little update from today. We're now running Sakai in full production with all of our faculty and students, and we've not had to add any additional FTEs to do that. We get a lot of support materials, our tier one support, and things like patches from RSmart, a commercial affiliate we're working with. And we've also worked with them to do our SIS integration. So we now have Sakai fully integrated with our student information system for things like course rosters and drop ads and things of that nature. Now I'm going to pause because I don't know when this session ends. Can anybody tell me when it ends? Oh, that's a good sign. You're so sucked in. 3:10. Okay, I'm going to accelerate then. So as I started off the section with in terms of these innovation factors, that was at the time something we thought had huge potential, we were very interested in, but honestly, we also realized that this could be a lot of hype and might not actually be realized. So as we implemented our pilots, we spent a lot of time looking at those innovation factors we had heard about and really saying, asking hard questions about, are we really seeing a more innovative product? Are we really seeing a cost savings? Are we getting better support from our commercial affiliates? And so we did things like cost projections based on switching to other enterprise LMSs. We tracked a lot of the capabilities coming out of Sakai in each version release, and things like resolution time from our support vendor. So we certainly quickly found, particularly because there's no licensing fees, that we saw significant cost savings over other commercial options, proprietary options. More importantly, though, we began to realize that what that really represented to us was the ability to shift our resources from a piece of paper that sits in my file cabinet, the license agreement from a priority vendor, to human capital. So we could, instead of spending $100,000 on a license, we might be able to hire another instructional designer. And we had a lot of confidence that an instructional designer is going to be able to do much more innovative things with our faculty members with this technology and our students than a piece of paper sitting in my file cabinet is going to do. We found technical issues were very rapidly responded to, both by RSmart as well as the community when we asked for their help. And I think I'd like to give this one example here because it's, one of many kind of ways we saw innovation occurring in the product. Early on, there was a podcasting tool, and the podcasting was just really exploding at the time. So an institution, I'm forgetting now which one, might have been Stanford, developed a podcasting tool for Sakai so instructors could put out podcasts right through the Sakai learning management system. A number of years earlier, we had won a Campus Technology Innovators Award for a podcasting project, but one where students had built podcasts, social podcasts, as groups as part of their online coursework. And so we had really seen a huge amount of benefit and innovation coming from our students building podcasts. So we put that use case forward and we said, listen, you know, it's great to have this podcasting tool, but it would be really innovative if we could have our students doing this podcasting, not just our faculty members. And the next version of the podcasting tool supported that use case and allowed students to contribute to podcasts. So I think that kind of rapid innovation was very impressive to us as well. Today we have over 20 what has been called contrib tools. These are these innovative experimental tools that get built and then eventually incorporated into the core release. Actually, I think Citation Helper is now part of the core release. And that's something we've just started to implement this past fall. And it's a way of integrating searches of your data library databases, your journal databases, right from within Sakai. So in a discussion posting, for example, student go in, click a little button, do a search against our journal database, let's say to find a reference to back up their opinion about something they're discussing in the discussion forum. And it automatically generates a citation for them with a link right back to that full text journal article that then other students can click on. So again, another example of innovation we're seeing. The lessons tool now supports the IMS Common Core Starches as well as SCORM. And I'm not quite up on this, but others might be. There's now emerging support for some of the new content sharing LTI-1 and other standards that are emerging right now. And the test and quizzes tool for some time has supported the QTI, the IMS QTI test and quiz question standard. Health of the Sakai community. I think if you go out and you're going to buy a big commercial license or a big enterprise license, a big commercial company, you're probably going to look at the financial stability of that company. Are they going to be bought out right away? Are they going to go out of business and so forth? Well, when you're looking at a community source project, you don't ask that question, but I think it's definitely important to ask the question of, is this community going to be around for the long term? And so we looked at things like, are more members coming in, more adoption or less? Are more commercial affiliates coming in and joining the group? Are deadlines being met? At the time, also the Blackboard patent infringement lawsuits against Desire to Learn had just really started to ramp up, and so there were concerns and questions about potential lawsuits on open source LMSs. And so you can see some of the evaluation criteria that we're tracking, here for this category as well. So one of the things that impressed us was the emergence of many, many new commercial affiliates over the time we were looking at it, and a diverse set of commercial affiliates. So we have commercial affiliates that directly provide support services like Unicon and RSmart, Sarasoft, Longsight, and so forth. But we also have some very, very large commercial affiliates as well, like IBM, Sun, and Oracle, who contribute in major ways as well. So seeing this diverse ecosystem of commercial affiliates was something that we felt built a lot of confidence in terms of using the product. Again, I'm just going to kind of accelerate here a little bit so we have some time for Q&A. We now have 160 institutions around the world using Sakai. I think a nice proof point is 5 out of the top 10 institutions around the world use Sakai, so I think that's an impressive factor as well. And Blackboard obviously hasn't done terribly well in its litigation against Desire to Learn on the patent front. The last factor I'll hit here is reliability and scalability. It might be a slightly strange one from a small institution like Marist to be caring about things like scalability, but one of our initiatives that we're starting now is an e-portfolio for life initiative. So we feel it's really important that if our students begin using electronic portfolios, that they can continue using them as alumni pretty much forever. But that also means that at some point in the not too distant future, we're not going to just be supporting 5,700 students, but we're going to be supporting 10, 15, 20, 30,000 alumni members as well with things like portfolios. So knowing that we had a system that could scale to a larger number of users than we've had in the past was important to us. Quality assurance. I mean, that was a big issue in terms of the myths around open source. If a bunch of people are just throwing code together in their basement, is this thing going to be really reliable? Security issues. I think that's been a big question out there sometimes with open source as well. So some of the outcomes here is that we actually found that and got involved with the quality assurance process, that it was a very robust software engineering process Sakai follows. This is not a bunch of people in their basement throwing code together. It's a bunch of professional software engineers at institutions working in a very professional way to build the product out. Sakai Foundation has a quality assurance director, coordinates the quality assurance process. Also, I think important to note is that although pretty much everything in Sakai is open and everything's out there for the public to see, good, bad, and ugly. The one exception are security issues, which are taken very seriously by the community. So when, and it's happened only a few times, but when a security issue is identified, it's not put out publicly on lists. There is kind of a back channel, private process used to alert institutions, the security officers at each institution about these issues, and pretty much everything gets dropped and focused on getting the security issues addressed. And obviously there's institutions like Indiana University, University of Cape Town, South Africa, with 100,000 plus users in the system. So unless we're really successful at Marist and have lots more alumni than we think, we're not going to have a problem scaling up to that larger numbers. And here we also found that integration with our student information system was actually much easier than we thought. That was something we were able to implement very quickly and resulted in a lot of productivity gains. But today there's also a lot of integrations with other commercial software out there, Luminate, Turnitin.com, and so forth. So I just thought I'd point, as I move off the evaluation process here, the last slide or two, note that if you're looking for another evaluation report to look at, UNC has just put out, just in the last couple of weeks, a really great report on their evaluation of Sakai, which I believe they benchmarked against Blackboard. So if you just do a Google search for UNC Sakai Evaluation Final Report, you'll find that online. I'll also note they have some really great faculty videos that they did, interviews that are on YouTube that are referenced in the report that I thought were really great to see. So a real last slide here, I think, where we are today and where we're headed. As I mentioned, we started our conversion in 2008, fall. The goal we had set, because we, again, gave faculty members the opportunity to opt in to Sakai so they didn't have to go and move over right away in the fall. So we had figured, you know, we'd be in a good shape if 20% of our faculty members opted into Sakai during the first semester. We actually ended up getting 65% to opt in, which I think was testimony to the value that they saw in Sakai and the product and tools. The conversion was completed this fall, 2009. Happy to say, too, that we had no kind of major revolt. There was no faculty member called up in August this year saying, oh, I've got to use the old LMS one more semester. So I thought we were very successful there. We're now seeing a very big uptick in these project sites, and earlier I mentioned these support ad hoc collaborations. So without even advertising this as a service, we're currently supporting over 150 project sites, from everything from search committees to faculty committees to these student clubs like our Habitat for Humanities Club, who uses it frequently to podcast from their home house building projects they're doing. We're running a lot of training services in terms of introduction to Sakai courses, refresher courses, open labs. I'll put a little plug in for my assistant director here, who's doing a poster session on our transition to Sakai later this afternoon, so you can learn a lot more about those at the poster session. And we're also providing faculty members with a migration service to help them migrate content from our old LMS to Sakai. And the next big thing on our horizon, well, closer than the horizon, because immediately on our plate are e-portfolios. And so we've been piloting those. We're moving those now into full production using the portfolio tools in Sakai. So with that, I've got about 5 or 6 minutes here for some Q&A. I'd be happy to stay after as well. So open it up for questions. Yes. No, it was a major concern at first. Our strategy was kind of two-pronged. We provided faculty members with an automated process to move their data. And we used, and I could answer more of these technical questions later on, but we basically had this kind of secure FTP to WebDAV product that helped us just very seamlessly move files, you know, over from one system to the other. It took about 2 minutes to move all the files over. Right, and so what we did there was we created this thing called a course migration guide. And we had graduate students in our office who would take the content. You know, an example would be assignment instructions. Okay, I spent 3 hours writing all these assignments up in the old LMS. I don't want to retype them in Sakai. So we would literally copy and paste these out of the old LMS, put it into this customized guide with instructions to the faculty member about how to put it into Sakai, kind of best practices. And then they came to workshops with us, and part of the workshop time was dedicated to them doing that. So we'd show them how to use the assignment tool in Sakai, then gives them some time with staff helping them to move it in. And any other grunt work that they couldn't finish, we'd have a graduate student help them with that. We intentionally decided to do that, Brian, to try to do more automation because we wouldn't want our faculty members waiting to the last minute to learn about Sakai. So if we'd done it all for them, they probably 2 days before the semester would have been, all right, I'm going to go start up using Sakai, and that probably wouldn't have worked so well. And also the scale. I mean, we're talking about 1,500, maybe 2,000 courses, which is manageable. If you have 30,000, the process we use might not be so much. Other questions? Early on, we did. I think for a range of reasons, it wasn't, when we started to say, okay, open source was really the direction we wanted to move in. One factor for us was the enterprise capabilities of Sakai, and I know that's debatable in terms of Moodle being run at an enterprise level at some institutions. At the time, there were maybe none, maybe just one. I think Open University in the UK was starting to look at Moodle, but we wanted to have something that was really going to scale for us. And then also, I think there's some real differences between their open source model and governance structure and the one that Sakai follows. And I'm not going to say one is better than the other, but they're different. And when we looked at those differences for Marist, the Sakai model made a lot more sense to us. And that was a big driver towards looking at Sakai or going with Sakai over Moodle. But I think it's very much a preference choice at your institution. We're very eager, yes, because of the innovation that it represents. And we could probably do a whole session. I think actually Michael's done a whole session yesterday on Sakai 3. So I'll just say that it's really going to, in our mind, represent a leap forward in the whole industry in terms of innovation in this space. Things like social networking, authoring of content in really powerful kind of wiki-like ways, things that we see our faculty members already starting to experiment with and having great success with, but Sakai 3 will facilitate that in some really new ways in terms of teaching and learning. It's still on the horizon, so in terms of the transition, I don't know that anybody knows exactly what that's going to be like, but I think the big selling point for us is that all of the community members are in that boat, and we are all going to be working very hard to make that the smoothest possible transition possible. So again, there's no profit margin there, so that the motivation isn't making money. It's about satisfying our customers, our faculty and students, and I think that's going to make that process a smooth one. I'm sure later on Michael and others could talk to you more about that. There was another question? Right now, since it's not an official thing we're offering, they let us know they're on a project site. It's kind of leaked out that this capability is there, and we just kind of manually create it for them. It takes about a minute and a half to create a project set, so it's not that big of a deal. And then again, since it's kind of an informal thing right now, we just kind of talk with them about, well, who do you want to be organizers versus maintainers or participants in the site, and just kind of consult with them and recommend, well, if you're in a faculty committee, you probably all want to have the same permissions. If it's a club, maybe it's different. We're looking right now at implementing a self-service process for course site creation, which is built into Sakai. We just haven't gotten there yet in terms of implementing that. Sakai's a bit of a different model instead of modules in Moodle. There's a lot more, I think, that's just part of the core release. There are what are called these contrib tools that are out there that you can download separately outside of the core release and install. Since we're working closely with RSmart, we kind of look to them to recommend to us, is this something we should be running in production or not? And wait for them to officially support it before we move it in production. But it's a two-way street. I mean, there's things, for example, we really needed the ability to start doing online course evaluations. And that was a contrib tool, so it wasn't officially part of the core release, but we were getting a lot of pressure from our deans to start implementing that. So we talked with RSmart. We said, listen, you're not supporting it right now, but really need it. And then within a couple of months, it was something that they were ready to have us support and start running. It's a subscription agreement, so we basically pay a subscription agreement every year based on our FTE headcount, and they have two kind of different subscriptions. I think it's called a basic or premium or something like that. We've opted to the premium level because of some of the additional services we're interested in getting. Still a major cost savings over our prior experiences, or at least other enterprise systems. I think there's some RSmart folks in the room here who could probably answer more questions for you. I will say that all of their pricing and everything is all public on their website, so you can go take a look at that. Okay, thanks a lot. I appreciate you coming out and for your time. And if you have more questions, I'll hang out here for a while. Yes, I'm sorry. So there are actually two Sakai-related poster sessions. The one I mentioned Ribana is doing. I'm also doing one on the Teaching with Sakai Innovations Award, which is an award program for faculty members. And that's going to be upstairs during the community showcase, which starts at 4:55 or something. So come join us up there if you'd like.